The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, for the last number of weeks that I've been here, been exploring these qualities of heart and mind that are cultivated and open us to the possibility of freedom in our lives, in our hearts, in our minds. The name of this list is called the Ten Paramis. Parami translated as supreme quality or perfection, something like that. And so each week I've been exploring one of these qualities. And right now I'll just name them so you get a sense of the list for those of you who haven't been here. And they are generosity, ethics, renunciation or letting go, wisdom, energy, patience, truthfulness, determination, kindness, and equanimity. And last time I spent a little bit of time talking about wisdom, and then I think Tony talked about wisdom and compassion for the last few weeks, so that's been in that terrain. And tonight what I'd like to do is explore this connection between wisdom and energy. To me, this connection is really like the engine of our practice, the engine of what we do, how we engage. The wisdom that the Buddha offered us is we could think about having wisdom around so many things, you know. And so it's useful to reflect on what did the Buddha mean by wisdom, or what does the wisdom of the Dharma point to? And what it points to is, based on the Buddha's exploration and what his orientation towards his journey was, which was, is it possible to be free of suffering in this life? What causes us to be so unhappy? What causes us, given that we would like to be happy, want to be happy, try to do things that make us happy, how do we end up caught back on this cycle of struggle? No matter what we do, it seems like. And so this was his quest. So the wisdom that the Buddha offers us revolves around understanding this question of suffering. So this is a pretty specific kind of wisdom. And, you know, at one point the Buddha, with his disciples, he was talking to his disciples, and he wandering through the forest, and he picked up a handful of leaves from the forest floor and said, which is greater, the number of leaves in my hands or the number of leaves on the trees in the forest? And they said, obviously, the number of leaves on the trees in the forest is greater. And he said, so too, what I teach for the purposes of freedom of suffering, from suffering, is like the leaves in my hand compared to what I know and understand. And so he even pointed to there being vaster kinds of wisdom that he didn't talk about, because he said, this is not what's important or what's crucial for freeing our minds from suffering. And so there's some very specific things he taught us, some very specific things he explored around what wisdom is, how we need to orient our minds in order to understand what creates suffering in our hearts and minds, what causes us to be caught on this cycle of suffering. You know, if we look at what happens, you know, our basic worldview, how does our basic worldview operate before we perhaps meet some of these teachings? For me, at least, and for many people, I think it is something along the lines of well, I need to get certain things. I need to create certain experiences. I need to have certain relationships in my life. I need to be a certain way. And if I can manage to construct all of that, that is what will bring happiness. This is, you know, this is kind of the almost the paradox of human life, that this is what we've learned will bring us happiness from the time we're very young. We get something that we like. We get something that we want. You know, we're hungry and we get fed and, you know, we feel better. And so that model of getting what we want and feeling better becomes the only model that we know in terms of finding happiness. And so the Buddha points out, the Buddha says, yes, you know, this is a model. You know, you can get what you want. I think I talked about this a few weeks ago, that when you get what you want, there is some happiness to that. But the Buddha asked us to explore, well, you know, how long does that actually last? Is it a really lasting kind of happiness when we get what we want? And when we look at that, we discover, well, actually, no. You know, maybe the thing that we get lasts in our lives for a little while, like, you know, we get something that we like or appreciate, and it stays with us for a long time, but somehow our enjoyment of it fades. And we go off looking for something else to enjoy. Or something ends and we go off looking for something else to enjoy. Or some problem happens and we try to figure out, well, how do I manage that? How do I get rid of that? And so the Buddha asks, he said, yes, there is a kind of happiness that comes from this habitual way or this familiar way that we're used to engaging in the world and finding happiness. But he said, you know, actually what I've discovered through my own journey is that it's a lesser kind of happiness than what's actually possible. What's possible, he points to a deeper kind of happiness that's possible independent of the conditions in the world, independent of what we have and what we can get rid of, but a kind of a mind that can be at ease, at peace, in this moment with whatever is happening in this moment. And that not meaning that because we are not resisting, reacting, wanting to hold on to, kind of fighting either to hold on to something or get rid of something in the present moment, that doesn't mean that that state of ease and peace means a non-active being. This is something that's hard for us to understand, I think, partly because so much of our action in the world has been motivated by wanting to hold on to things, wanting to get rid of things. And so it's almost like we can't fathom any other motivation for wanting to do something. And we envision, perhaps, the idea might be that, well, if my heart is at ease with what's here in the present moment, why would I do anything? And it's a paradoxical thing, but when the heart is at ease with what's happening in the present moment, it also feels very deeply. At ease doesn't mean it doesn't feel the joys in the world and the sorrows in the world. In fact, the heart that is not fighting with what's here feels much more deeply and is inspired to act, not from reactivity, not from wanting to hold on to something, but from wisdom, from compassion. So this is a kind of a reorientation, a kind of a shift of perspective for us. Even hearing the peaceful heart would want to act, maybe something that doesn't sound very familiar to us. And so the wisdom of the Buddha is oriented around this kind of shift of perspective, that it's possible to find ease and peace with what is happening. in the world, with things as they are. And yet in that very ease and peace, we then step forward, not with reactivity, but with a heart that resonates and wants to bring those qualities of compassion, of joy, of ease, of peace, of generosity, all of these qualities that we're talking about, wants to bring more of that into the world. So this is kind of a shift of perspective for us. And so with wisdom, there's understood to be a kind of a three different levels of wisdom that maybe correspond to they're said to correspond kind of to the just information that we hear, the first level of wisdom. And so the first thing that the Buddha had to do in his teaching career was to begin talking about this perspective, begin exploring with other people, you know, saying, hey, you know, this is a different way to think about things, but try it on. See what you think. And so that's that first wisdom, that we actually have to hear this new perspective. We actually have to hear something about what the Buddha offered. And then, this is where energy comes in. Because it takes some interest in beginning to apply that wisdom into our own lives. And so this is a way in which there's a way that each of the qualities in this list is said to kind of both support the next quality, lead us onward to the next quality, and that as that next quality comes into play in our minds, it feeds back and supports the strengthening and perfection of the previous quality. And so with wisdom, the way this works between wisdom and energy, and this really feels like the engine of our practice here, because there's some amount of wisdom. We hear some wisdom, and the wisdom of the Buddha, you know, it doesn't come with this kind of like, believe this, this is all you need to do to believe this. The wisdom of the Buddha includes, this is a perspective that you can cultivate by exploring this perspective directly in your practice, in your experience. And so the energy, this next quality of energy, is asked to pick up that wisdom and begin to apply it in our daily lives, in our meditation, looking at what is this wisdom asking us to do. And so what this wisdom is asking us to do, there's a couple of ways that's expressed. The most succinct expression of that wisdom is the Four Noble Truths. The truth of suffering. Again, these are framed around suffering. You know, this is where the Buddha, he explored. This is what he really wanted us to understand. So the truth of suffering, the truth of the cause of suffering, the truth of the ending of suffering, and the truth of the path leading to the ending of suffering. And each of those truths is not simply meant to be believed, not simply meant to be taken in as some truth that we, you know, hold on to and say, yes, I believe in the Four Noble Truths. He encouraged us to act. He said, we need to understand suffering. We need to let go of the cause of suffering, this kind of wanting things to be other than they are, wanting to hold on to things that we like, wanting to get rid of things we don't like, endlessly trying to arrange our lives to be the way we'd like them to be, as opposed to, Ah, well, it's like this right now. Can there be some ease with this? Beginning to explore that possibility. So letting go of the cause of suffering, realizing the ending of suffering, and cultivating the path leading to the ending of suffering. And so he placed the wisdom with action, not just to take it in, but also to begin to explore, to reflect on how might this work in my life. And this is the next level of wisdom. The second level of wisdom is said to actually be, okay, you've heard something. The second level of wisdom involves your own reflection, your own thinking about, your own understanding. And so this is applying energy. This is bringing a kind of a massaging, reflecting on, does this make any sense to me? How might it work for me? When I first heard the wisdom of the Buddha, well, another piece I'll say here is that the wisdom of the Buddha is really dense. You know, it's like even one little bit of it. There's a lot. It's expressed in a lot of different ways. You know, the Four Noble Truths, dependent origination, the three characteristics. There's all these different ways it's expressed. But, you know, if there's any little piece that resonates for you, it's like each little piece of wisdom, if you go in and explore that, it will open you up to a broader understanding of what he was talking about. And so, for instance, for myself, the first book I read about Buddhism was Everyday Zen by Joko Beck. A friend had sent it to me, partly because I was suffering so much, and she had found it to be so helpful. And I read that book, and I'd say 90% of it went over my head. But there was one piece in there that was interesting to me, and it resonated for me with what was going on, which was that there was a lot of anger in my life, and it was out of control. And the little bit of wisdom that was offered in that book was, try being aware of your difficult emotions rather than acting on them. And, you know, I didn't even know how that would function or work. But I trusted my friend who'd said she'd had some benefit from this book and the practice. And I had tried other things and nothing had really helped me. And so I thought, well, you know, maybe I'll give it a try. Let me try this. I'll see what happens if I notice that I'm angry. If I recognize, oh, okay, yes, this is anger. Anger is happening. And that's where my practice began. And that little bit of wisdom within the space of a few months had very potent impact on my on that pattern of anger. It had helped me to see so much about what was going on and helped me to release a lot of it. It was like magic to me. Nothing else had worked. Nothing else had any traction for me. And this simple practice of, no, okay, yep, anger, that's what's happening right now. Within the space of a few months, there was a huge shift in my capacity to be with my experience and not get so caught or lost in the anger. And so this was a little bit of wisdom meeting energy. Now, I said, you know, reflect on it. Does it make sense to us? In that case, it was like, no, this doesn't make any sense to me. I don't understand how this would work. But the key piece there was that I was willing to try it. And so this was the engagement, a willingness to explore that possibility. And so this is, again, bringing the energy. And so this practice relies on energy. It relies on application. And then as we explore, as we apply the energy in the direction of that wisdom, we begin to see some things for ourselves. We begin to see how it is that our minds get caught by particular patterns or habits. We might see our mind release a pattern or habit, or even just see something as simple as I saw the very first time that I noticed my anger, which was I woke up in the midst of a rage, and about all I could do was recognize, yep, I know I'm angry. I have no idea what to do with this, but I guess I go back to work. And that little shift, and it was not even in that moment that I noticed this shift, but later I recognized that before I had woken up and realized, oh, anger is happening, I had been sitting frozen at my desk, unable to even think because I was so enmeshed in my story of rage. And that moment of coming into awareness had broken that kind of bubble of insular existence around the anger and allowed me to go back to work. And so that effort applied to just being with it had created some space and created a little bit of possibility for a new relationship with that anger. And so this is kind of the power of how wisdom and energy work together, this back and forth between the two. And so we begin to understand some of that wisdom directly for ourselves. And this is the third level of wisdom, that as we have taken in the wisdom, reflected on it, decided, well, I'll give it a try. Sometimes I suggest that, if you don't see how it's going to work, well, are you willing at least to run the experiment? That was kind of the way I approached that. It's like, I don't see how this is going to work, but I'm willing to run the experiment and see what the results are. And within very short time, the space of a few weeks, I understood that there were very beneficial results of doing this simple, simple thing. And so even just that very instruction, the wisdom, see what it means to be aware that you're feeling a reactive emotion and know that that's happening in the present moment. So this is equivalent to acknowledging, anger is happening, fear is happening, confusion is happening. Kind of the acknowledgement of this is what's happening right now in the present moment. Right there, that instruction embeds wisdom because it is creating a new relationship to the emotion. It's creating a new relationship to that experience, which previously, for most of us, at least for me, was, I'm angry. What happens in my mind is I jump on that anger, I think about it, I think about who I'm angry at and what I need to do to prove to them that they're wrong and I'm right. And it's like tumbling on, it's like the foot is on the gas pedal and the anger is growing. That movement to, anger's happening in the present moment, is like taking the foot off the gas pedal. It creates a different relationship to the anger and allows something different to happen. And so even that little piece, embeds a huge bit of the Buddha's wisdom. So with respect to energy and wisdom, energy itself, energy is what the factor or force that is kind of motivating us or keeping us alive. We have energy running through our system. And that energy is, it's basically neutral. Energy itself is kind of a neutral quality. And so the same kind of energy will hook on to anger and rage and confusion and frustration and have us charging off in that direction. as can kind of connect to wisdom and take us in a different direction. And so the energy of our practice is the energy that is infused with wisdom, with this wisdom of the Buddha's practice, the Buddha's teaching. So I said the Four Noble Truths was one of the frameworks for that. The one I'd really like to explore today is the framework of related to the First and Second Noble Truths is that, so the First Noble Truth, there is suffering, and the Second Noble Truth, there is a cause of suffering, that the Buddha in his getting familiar with his own mind began to recognize that there were certain habits or patterns of mind that tended to head us in the direction of suffering. And those were, he identified as greed, aversion, and delusion. And there are other habits or patterns of mind that tend to lead us away from suffering. Those are non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion. Or we could frame them more positively as generosity, love, and wisdom. Non-greed, generosity, non-aversion, love, non-delusion, wisdom. And so he kind of laid those out and said, look in your own mind, and you'll actually see that when greed is present in your mind, there is suffering happening. When greed is present in the mind, there is already some feeling that something is lacking. When there's wanting present, there's already the sense that I don't have something, something's wrong, something's off. I need to have that thing to fill this hole. And so the very wanting creates the sense of this hole that needs to be filled. And so already when wanting is present, there is a kind of an instability in the mind, a sense of contraction, a sense of things aren't okay in this moment. When aversion is present in the mind, this one's a little easier to see. When aversion's present in the mind, it doesn't feel good. I think a lot of us are motivated when there's aversion present in the mind to get rid of the aversion because aversion doesn't feel very good. And we don't like the way it feels to be angry. And, you know, it's amazing to me, though, what we think is going to help anger, you know. In my own exploration of anger, you know, it's like I thought somehow that making the other person miserable was going to make me feel better. So this quality of aversion, the quality of greed, when we look at it in our experience, we see it doesn't feel very good. There's suffering there. And then the quality of delusion or ignorance is kind of the ground out of which greed and aversion even grow. Because, you know, wanting itself, we could say wanting is the reaching out to have something that we think will fill this hole, that we think will satisfy this urge. So the wanting is the reaching out. But the delusion of wanting is that happiness will follow from getting that thing. That's the whole motivation, in a sense. There's the feeling of lack, but there's also this sense of, you know, wanting is telling us the only way to get rid of that lack is to have that thing that I want. That's the delusion of wanting. That the only way to make that lack go away and thereby be happy is to get that thing that I want. Kind of likewise with aversion. The story of aversion is the only way to have that feeling of aversion go away is to either get rid of that thing or get myself out of here. Greed is not going to tell you that once greed goes away, whether or not you have the thing, once greed goes away, the feeling of lack goes away, and there's no problem. Once aversion goes away, the feeling of aversion is the problem. And so the delusion is kind of the confusion out of which this all springs. The whole patterning around the usual way that we try to construct our lives. And so one of the teachings basically is to begin to look at, okay, when greed, aversion, and delusion are present in the mind, we start to get familiar with that. We start to recognize, first of all, just begin to recognize, oh, when this is present, this hurts. As I was exploring my anger in the very first few weeks of that practice that I did, that was another bit of wisdom that was like this big aha moment. It's like, it seems so obvious in retrospect, but my mind was so caught up with the idea that my anger was going to make the other person miserable that I missed that I was miserable while I was angry. And as I began noticing, oh, this is what it's like to be angry, I recognized, wow, you know, actually, the person that I'm angry with is 7,000 miles away. They don't even know I'm angry. They're not suffering, but I am miserable. And so this is a little bit of insight. This is a little bit of kind of the aha moment of, oh, I see. This actually isn't helpful. This is not the way this being really wants to go. But before that, there had been this delusion that somehow it was serving me to be angry. So the exploration around looking at when these are present in our minds, this is part of what the teaching on wise effort is. And this is, again, part of the teaching on energy. The teaching on, there's an interesting combination or connection between energy and effort, actually. You know, we need energy to make effort. That seems obvious. And yet, what's interesting, too, is that as we make effort in the way that the Buddha prescribes with wise effort, it creates its own kind of energy. And this is what the Buddha actually, how he defined the energy of the parami. He said, this spiritual quality of energy, the energy directed to the practice, is the energy that results from making wise effort. So we often think about using up energy as we make effort, but here the Buddha is pointing to us, if you do this in a certain way, if you explore this practice in a certain way, actually what will happen is that you'll end up making energy. It will enliven you to make wise effort. And part of the reason I think this works is because there is a lot of energy consumed by greed, aversion, and delusion. Greed, aversion, and delusion use up a lot of energy. And we can also see this as we start to watch our minds. And so as we, instead of allowing those energies to take over and send us hurtling down through our lives, kind of on autopilot with the energy directed towards greed, aversion, and delusion, as we turn it and explore, oh, this is what it's like to feel anger. This is what it's like to feel wanting. The energy that we'd been consuming and using up with those actions of unhelpful mind states gets freed up. Way less energy. And you know, this is it takes some doing to get here, actually. I mean, I would say when I first started looking at this, I wouldn't say it was obvious to me that it freed up energy for me to kind of turn towards looking at anger. It felt like it took a lot of energy to do that. And yet over time, what I see is just how much easier it is to recognize, oh yeah, anger's happening right now, than be caught in this kind of spiral of almost automatic patterns and reactivity. All those automatic patterns and reactivity use up so much energy. So this wise effort that the Buddha encouraged us to make, there's four ways he talked about it. Two ways relate to these reactive states of mind, the states of mind that lead us towards suffering. So he suggested that we recognize, he said we should explore the possibility of avoiding those difficult, unwholesome, unskillful states that have not yet arisen. And so, well, I'll talk about those two first. And then the other is if there is an unwholesome, unskillful state, and that's all of these states that arise out of greed, aversion, and delusion, we could pretty much call them all of the reactive emotions. Any of those, if they are arising, then the exploration is, what does it mean to let them go? And so that's half of the work of wise effort, to explore kind of not following the trajectory, our habitual trajectory towards those patterns, and learning how to let go of them as we see them happening. The other half of wise effort is about exploring the other side of the equation, the wholesome states of mind. Non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion. This includes all of the paramis that I mentioned earlier. It includes love and compassion and kindness and wisdom and generosity and compassion and calm and concentration and tranquility and joy. It includes all of that. So to cultivate those, cultivate them when they have not arisen and maintain them when they have arisen. And so to look at each of these sides just briefly, what does it mean to avoid unwholesome states that have not arisen? You know, it sounds like, you know, avoid unwholesome states that have not arisen. That's three negatives in the sentence. I think we could simplify it by just kind of recognizing, you know, what we do as we explore our hearts and minds is we begin to see what catches us, what situations kind of lead us down the garden path, have us acting out of our habitual reactivity, and learn what helps us keep from going there. And so this might be some simple things like, you know, we see when we don't eat breakfast in the morning, we tend to get more reactive. Or if we don't get enough sleep, we tend to be more reactive. And so we can, you know, just do some simple things to avoid the possibility, or to avoid the kind of what we might see as, you know, wow, when I do this, this seems to happen. You know, I get really hungry and I get really short. It's like, okay, well, that's pretty easy to avoid. So that's kind of the simple way to look at it or think about it, is that, you know, there's certain conditions we watch what goes on. You know, you might notice that, you know, it's political season, so maybe there's a certain conversations that you have with certain people that, you know, it goes fine because you share similar views. And then another person that you find, you know, it always ends up in a really contentious and unpleasant situation that you end up saying things that you wish you hadn't said. You know, maybe it might be helpful to not go there with that particular person. So, you know, there's that kind of avoiding that we can explore. And then there's a kind of a subtler kind of avoiding, which isn't so much about like just cutting things out of our lives, but more here's a way to look at this. So we might think, okay, I should just for the next 5 months not see that person because the political conversation would not be a good idea. So I just won't see that person. So that's one way to go in terms of avoiding. This is, you know, just as kind of giving you a kind of example. But another way to go might be not to avoid seeing the person entirely, but to see what it would mean to recognize when the conversation's heading in a direction that's creating tension in your heart, and maybe taking a deep breath and just not engaging. You know, if the other person brings up the topic, it's just like, okay, I don't buy into that conversation. So this is a more challenging form of avoiding, where you're in the situation, but you're using mindfulness to help yourself avoid the eruption of the challenging state of mind. And then on the side of, you know, so it has erupted. We end up in some difficult situation, a time when we're seeing a greed or aversion in our minds. What happens there? The teaching is, I think the word is abandon. We abandon those unwholesome states that have arisen. And so we might think that means we simply stop doing it. There's aversion in the mind, so we turn it off. We stop being averse. That's what we might think abandon means, and, well, good luck. I've not had much success with that. But what is possible, I mean, there's sometimes where we can kind of change the channel. You know, we might be able to, and the Buddha suggests this, at times, he says, you know, if you have a difficult state of mind, you could try stopping thinking about that thing and turn your attention to think about something else. You know, actively just replace the thoughts in your mind. Sometimes that might work. You know, you might be able to, if you see your mind heading in a direction of, you know, anger over a particular situation, you know, oh, well, okay, I could let go of thinking those thoughts. And what I will do instead is I'll actively think about something else. I'll bring a situation into my mind that has more of a metta quality to it. I'll reflect on somebody who's having something happen to them that I am happy for them about. So you can try that kind of abandoning. That kind of abandoning where you're actively like trying to put down or set aside a difficult state of mind has to be done really carefully, because if there's any movement of aversion in the mind towards that challenging, difficult state of mind or repression, it's going to kind of drive it underground, and kind of just gains its momentum in the dark, in the buried underground. So it's possible at times to shift or to change the channel when we see a difficult mind state. But for me, more often what abandoning means is that very first thing that I talked about, which is a shift from kind of following the state of mind and allowing it to perpetuate in your mind, you know, allowing it to kind of control the direction, and shift instead to, oh, this is what it's like to feel this difficult experience. This is what it's like to feel this. We could say this is a kind of abandoning, not through letting go or pushing away or turning off, but a letting go through a letting be. So this is a form of abandoning, and this is much of our practice, as we engage in looking at what's going on, we see, oh, this difficult state is happening. And the kind of 90-degree turn or 180-degree turn is, oh, right, and this is just happening in the present moment. This is how it feels. This is what's going on. This is a mind state that's arising in the present moment. This is how it's feeling in the body in the present moment. And so you're coming into alignment with the truth that this is what's happening now. You're not repressing it, but you're also not buying into it. You're not following it, and it's like your foot is not on the gas pedal. And because of that, it can begin to weaken. And so this is that second kind of wise effort. Then the third and fourth kinds of wise effort around wholesome states are, again, beginning to recognize these wholesome qualities. We can actually cultivate them. You know, we can cultivate loving kindness through orienting towards wishing people well. We can bring in a practice of the third one is to cultivate wholesome states that have not yet arisen. And so we can cultivate loving kindness, we can cultivate compassion, we can cultivate generosity through practices. You know, if they're not present already, through the way we act in the world, we can incline our minds in that direction. Practicing generosity, practicing giving, if our heart is interested in cultivating generosity, can incline the mind towards the open-hearted feeling of generosity. Practicing loving kindness through reflecting on well wishes for people. You know, may you be happy, even if you're not feeling it in that moment. If you connect to that wish, may you be happy. And even just simply understand the dictionary definition, meaning of those words. What I'm wishing is for you to have happiness in your life. That is a wish that I aspire to. Even that will begin to head the heart in the direction of kindness. So there are practices that we can do that encourage, inspire our hearts to head in that direction. With each of these paramis, for instance, you know, it's a I said on one day that, you know, creativity can kind of be, we can create our own practices around each of these. If you're interested in exploring any one of these, you know, patience, for instance, create practices that might support patience in your life. Create practices that might support ethics in your life. Creates practices that might support truthfulness in your life. So we can create our own. We can be creative around this. And this, for me, in my daily life, this has been a big part of my practice, is looking at these paramis and trying to find ways to engage with them in the midst of my daily life. So we can incline towards wholesome states that are not present through this kind of an action of intention. I'd like to head in that direction, and so I'm going to act in ways that will encourage that. Then the fourth is to maintain wholesome states that have arisen. And this one, you know, when I first heard that, I thought, well, why would that take any effort? You know, why would you have to even think about that? But then as I started looking at my mind and realizing that, well, there's all kinds of tendencies in the mind that might surprise us. You know, I at one point was sitting having breakfast, and For some reason, you know, there was all this joy arising, and, you know, I thought, wow, this is too intense. I can't handle this. And that was a surprise to me, but there was kind of this, and other times too, like with the feelings of expansive metta, it's like the mind kind of shuts it down and says, this is stupid, this is sappy. You know, so like our minds have habits and kind of relationships with these wholesome qualities. Sometimes it feels like they put us in a place of vulnerability, or they make us like stupid or something. You know, that's kind of what the comment was in my mind around this feeling of expansive love. It's like, well, this is stupid. This is like, you know, this is not a place of clarity and wisdom. This is like gushy, ushy stuff. And so the mind had views and opinions and kind of shut down that wholesome state. And so it sometimes does take work to maintain wholesome states that have arisen. Probably the best thing we can do there is mindfulness. Being mindful of these qualities. Recognize when you're patient. Recognize when you're feeling kind. You know, they come through our lives, these states. They come through our lives, and we don't often consciously recognize, like kind of I was saying, you know, we need to consciously recognize, oh, anger is happening. We also need to consciously recognize love is happening right now. Kindness is happening right now. Generosity is happening right now. We have some resistance to that at times because it feels somehow like we're, you know, puffing ourselves up or something. But this kind of recognition, it's not, I'm so great, I'm feeling that, but it's, no, this is a beautiful quality. Love is happening right now. So this is this other side of wise effort. So it's time to stop. I think I'll just say one, it says it's 8:59, so I'll say one last piece. And that is, you know, just the very act of mindfulness, this simplicity of turning towards whatever's happening in the moment. Sometimes people are a little confused. It's like, you know, it sounds like wise effort, we're actively doing things, you know, we're looking at these wholesome states and trying to cultivate them and maintain them, and looking at these unwholesome states, trying to let go of them. But the simplicity of mindfulness, and when people hear about that, it's like, well, that's, you're just supposed to be watching, not doing anything. But that very activity of, okay, let me know anger's happening in this moment while it's happening. Let me know that love is happening in this moment while it's happening. That movement of mindfulness includes the four right efforts just in that moment. And so, for example, around anger, as we are noticing anger in the present moment, right then and there, it is the process of that letting be. So we're engaged in that kind of wise effort around not having the foot on the gas pedal, but we're in that process of abandoning. We're in that process of letting be and letting go. That very process of letting be and letting go creates the conditions in the future for less of that anger to arise. And so as we explore that, we are creating the conditions for that to happen less often in the future. And so that's that first kind of wise effort, avoiding unwholesome states that have not arisen. You know, the very act of recognizing, oh yeah, this difficult state of mind, this hurts, creates the conditions for us to go there less in the future. And then as we're doing that, as we're engaged in that, we are cultivating patience and energy and mindfulness and concentration. So we're on the side of why, of the beautiful wise efforts too. We're cultivating ones that hadn't been there, and we're maintaining them as we practice. And so just that act of mindfulness brings it all together. And it brings the wisdom into play as well. So next week I think I'll follow a little more on effort, and then I'll take some questions. So come with questions. Thank you.